Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, running across the top of the page, Drug Shortages Plaguing Local Hospitals. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. And on the far left side of the article, there's a picture of a woman in a lab coat standing inside of a pharmacy. The caption reads, Wake Med's Lynn Eschenbacher says the issue of drug shortages is bad and getting worse. Local hospitals are facing drug shortages that leave their pharmacists scrambling daily, forcing doctors to use alternatives that are not always a perfect match. The shortages that are being felt all across the country are brought on because producers of generic drugs, particularly intravenous drugs, are discontinuing low-margin products. What's worse, a solution to the problem seems far away, with some medical professionals urging Washington to step in and control the production and flow of these endangered drugs. This year is worse than other years, says Lynn Eschenbacher, WakeMed Raleigh campus manager of pharmacy. Only a few years ago, WakeMed Health and hospitals would have as few as two drugs go on shortage per year, she says. These days, it's not unusual to deal with two shortages a week. Since June of last year, Eschenbacher has been notified of more than 100 shortages. In other hospitals, it's the same story, says Marianne Ortel, clinical specialist with the Department of Pharmacy at UNC Healthcare. Her hospital has 64 drugs listed on the critical shortage list, among 90 total items being monitored. It's a terrible, terrible problem, and I do not know when it is going to end, Ortel says. We've gone another degree over the edge into this shortage. It doesn't seem like there is an end in sight. A problem with profits. Those in the industry point to manufacturers of generic drugs as the main reason for the shortage. These manufacturers are stopping production on generics because there are bigger profits to be earned with other products. In an American free market system, simple laws of supply and demand might correct the market. If there is a shortage, a drug manufacturer could fill the void and charge a higher rate to make that product more profitable. However, in a system in which the federal government sets rates through Medicare, the free market does not work as expected, explains Walter Kalmans, a former McKesson Corporation executive, who now runs Lantra Ventures, a pharmaceutical consulting group. Under the 2003 Medicare Modernization Act, the federal government sets quarterly hospital reimbursement rates based on the average drug sales price from two quarters prior. Competition will drive the price down over time, but the six-month lag in the Medicare reimbursement rate prevents prices from going back up. Take a generic chemotherapy injection called carboplatin, for example. In January 2005, one unit sold for $125.47 on average. By July 2006, the average unit sales price was down to $8.83 and steadily decreased to $3.55 by January 2011, according to data available through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. There is no way for the free market to function, Kalmans, a Duke University Fuqua School of Business alum, says. In a free market system, when a competitor exits the market, the remaining players raise prices and ramp up production to fill the void. Once the margins erode, they choose to use their finite manufacturing capacity to manufacture higher margin generics. He says the MMA has been effective in controlling the costs of branded drugs, but that had the consequence of hurting the generic drug side of the industry. He suggested a new policy that would allow Medicare to quickly increase the reimbursement of generic drugs before more go on shortage. That would keep profit margins up and preserve the incentive for manufacturers to make the generics. Making do with substitutes. The drugs on shortage are varied and could affect nearly anyone who enters a hospital, says Eschenbacher. For example, WakeMed has had a shortage of Mucomist, which is used for Tylenol overdoses, Gentamicin, an antibiotic used by both adults and children, and electrolytes for patients who can't eat and need intravenous nutrition. Daily updates to shortages are available through the American Society of Health System Pharmacists website. Instead of focusing on the negative of drug shortages, Eschenbacher lauded the work of pharmacy teams for finding close matches for a drug on shortage. If we are running low, then what we have to look at are alternatives. If there are other drugs clinically approved, then we start making subs, she says. Eschenbacher and Ortel both say they have to devote hours each week to shortages. Congress is considering a bill that would force drug manufacturers to notify the U.S. Food and Drug Administration 6 months in advance of a planned cutback in production. That would allow the FDA enough time to alert other manufacturers of the same drug to suggest they ramp up production. Industry experts see the bill as a good start, but just a band-aid for the larger problem. The real issue is when there is a shortage of certain drugs that people need critically, says Fred Eckel, executive director of the North Carolina Association of Pharmacists and editor-in-chief of Pharmacy Times. Whether you know 6 months ahead of time, if there isn't a decent substitute, you still have the problem. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America released a statement saying it is deeply concerned with patients' well-being and listed several reasons for the shortages, but did not mention profit margins. A spokeswoman directed questions about profits to the Generic Pharmaceutical Association. David Balian, spokesman for the Generic Pharmaceutical Association, disputed assertions that producers were stopping production simply based on profits. I would say that we strongly disagree with that assertion, he wrote in an email. Instead, he pointed to issues such as the lack of communication and coordination between the FDA Office of Compliance and the FDA Office of Drug Shortages, or overpurchasing by wholesalers. And our next article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, it's in the center of the page, takes up most of the front page, has a black border around it. Inside that border, the right side of the area inside has a picture. It's a picture of a young woman casually dressed, leaning against a building, standing outside of the building. The caption reads, Rachel Week says it's cheaper to manufacture in the U.S. than in Sri Lanka when all costs are considered. And then on the left side, there's the headline and then the article under it. The headline, Schools in for Durham Clothes Firm, Schoolhouse Inshoring Jobs from Sri Lanka to Wendell. And this article is written by Monica Chen with a Dateline of Durham. Collegiate apparel company Schoolhouse is relocating its manufacturing from Sri Lanka to Wendell. In an unusual inshoring move, the owner says will actually result in savings for the company. Mortex Apparel has been contracted by Schoolhouse to get the work that's been done since 2008 in Sri Lanka, creating 20 jobs in Wendell. Schoolhouse founder and owner Rachel Week says costs associated with doing business abroad added up. That, combined with paying a living wage to workers, meant that when the company added it all up, the Tar Heel State turned out to be more cost-effective, to the tune of an about 5% margin improvement. When you factor in all the cost of duty and freight and inspection with doing business abroad, it can be extremely expensive, Week says. Plus, she says manufacturing stateside offers a more competitive lead time. Other North Carolina companies also will get a piece of the Schoolhouse action, including Contempora Fabric in Lumberton, for fabric, Castle Shirt Company in Kernersville, screen printing, Logitech Solutions in Wilson, shipping and storage, Box Board Products in Greensboro, box supplier, and Morissette Paper in Greensboro, poly bags. Week says the factory in Sri Lanka has committed to continuing to pay a living wage to workers, and Schoolhouse might return there after achieving some economy of scale. Schoolhouse's move will provide some boost to the state's textile industry, which has been in decline for the past two decades as companies have shifted manufacturing overseas for cheap labor. From 1996 to 2006, the number of textile plants and workers shrank by 40% and 65% respectively, according to Duke University. Eric Henry, president of TS Designs, a Burlington-based social enterprise that makes an all-North Carolina-manufactured brand called Cotton of the Carolinas, says there is growing awareness on the part of consumers to buy locally made apparel. Similar to the farm-to-table movement for restaurants, there is the dirt-to-shirt movement for apparel. But segments of North Carolina's industry were damaged with offshoring of labor, Henry says, and will take time to build back. Anything that requires labor was hurt, Henry says. They're growing the cotton here, they're spinning the cotton here, but they're taking the yarn and shipping that overseas. Weeks came up with the idea for Schoolhouse while an undergraduate studying women's studies at Duke University. She founded the company after traveling to Sri Lanka as a Fulbright scholar. The company has hit a niche in college apparel by combining the living wage ethos with fresh takes on college apparel design. The new in-state manufacturers will make Schoolhouse's next generation of products and be the engine of its expansion in 2011. The company's designs were in 46 campus stores nationwide in 2010, mostly operated by Barnes & Noble. In 2011, the designs have expanded to 53 more campus stores and are getting a test run with Follett Higher Education Group, which manages 850 campus bookstores. To fund the expansion, Schoolhouse closed a $862,500 fundraising round this month. The company is seeking an additional $75,000 line of credit to take it to profitability by the end of the year. The company had $690,000 in revenue last year. The goal this year is $1.5 million. Schoolhouse hit some bumps in fundraising, according to Weeks, because the company does not belong to the dominant industries in the triangle with which angel and institutional investors are familiar. So Weeks enlisted the support of other socially conscious entrepreneurs in the area. Christopher Gergen, director of social entrepreneurship incubator, Bull City Forward, and Ryan Alice, CEO of iContact, are investors in Schoolhouse. As an entrepreneur, you've got to figure out how to plug into that national network and tell a great story, Gergen says. From our end, we're looking into ways we can increase the quality of deal flow coming into our region. And now we move just to the right of that article for our next article written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Credit Lawyers Want Story Out. Call it a sign of the times, financial, legal, or even psychological. Tired of constantly being portrayed as a villain, attorneys in the state who represent banks and other financial institutions in debt collection proceedings have formed an organization to tell their side of the story. The group, called the North Carolina Creditors Bar Association, has been in the works for several months and now is going public as an industry advocate and educational resource. The association is helmed by President Jerry Myers, who is the managing partner of Raleigh law firm Smith Debnam. Myers says, "We get painted as the bad guys when trying to enforce contracts that the debtor signed but didn't honor. It's not a very popular job," he says, of being a creditor's attorney. That's not surprising. Banks took quite a public relations beating during the Great Recession and its fallout, from criticism over the pre-downturn loans they made to the collection tactics they used after the economy went south. Creditors' attorneys felt the ire when they marched off to represent their clients in legal proceedings, such as bankruptcy hearings, debt collection, and judgment enforcement. There's already a number of organizations that provide advocacy services on behalf of debtors. The creditors' attorneys decided it was time to form a group that would represent their interests. The idea is to kind of tell that other side, says David Warren, a partner at Raleigh-based Pointer Spruill, who's the association's treasurer. Carlene McNulty, an attorney and consumer advocate with the North Carolina Justice Center, a liberal public policy group, says the association is superfluous. "They already have all the power in their hands," she says. "I don't know what they need. I don't know that they need an association." About 40 attorneys statewide have joined the association so far. To be eligible, members must devote at least 25% of their time to creditor representation, according to information provided by Myers. While it has the words Bar Association in its title, Myers Group is not affiliated with the North Carolina Bar Association, which is a trade and advocacy group that represents all lawyers in the state. However, creditors' rights attorneys can be members of both organizations. It is not surprising that as lawyers narrow their focus and have more and more of a niche practice, they would want to collect themselves in a way to be more responsive to their clients. Alan Head, the NCBA executive director, wrote in an email response to a request for comment. So what exactly will the creditors' bar do? Members plan to keep close tabs on General Assembly bills that would affect their practice. They already are watching the progress of a couple, one regarding wage garnishment and another focusing on property exemptions. While the association doesn't have a lobbying capability yet, members hope to develop one in the future. The group also is designing a program that can be used to educate high school and community college students on ways they can avoid debt trouble. So, given the recent unpopularity of banks and their representatives, is Myers expecting a hostile response to the formation of the Creditors' Rights Association? I wouldn't think so, he says. We're just nice people. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article was written by Monica Chen with a Dateline of Durham. The headline, it's tenuous, but 540 home project given shot at Jumpstart. And this article runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. On the far right, there's a map showing the area we'll discuss in the article. Plans call for 422 acres on the eastern edge of Durham County to be developed into a subdivision called Sierra with 540 single-family houses. That would make Sierra the largest residential project to be developed in the Triangle since the start of the recession, real estate experts say, but here's the rub. It's uncertain whether those plans will be executed. The plans were filed by East Durham Land Company, LLC, an entity formed by Steve Fowler, former president of Fowler Contracting, a Cary site preparation and landscaping company that closed during the recession. Phase 1, with 176 acres north of the northeastern corner of Leesville Road and Doc Nichols Road, was approved by Durham officials in 2008, but has yet to be built. Phase 2, with 246 acres, is making its way through the Durham City County Planning Department. Attempts to reach Fowler were unsuccessful. Phone numbers for Fowler have been disconnected, and there was no response at an email query. Tim Sivers, an engineer with Horvath Associates Incorporated, the Durham landscape and design firm working on Sierra, says Fowler is looking for a buyer. The owner is, last I heard, still looking for someone to purchase the land, the site plan, and build the lots, Sivers says. It's not unusual, primarily because of the economy, this project has been in a holding pattern. Nick Tennyson, Vice President of the Home Builders Association of Durham, Orange, and Chatham Counties, says what would be unusual is any development right now. The reality is we haven't heard about or seen a lot of large-scale development being attempted, Tennyson says. However, there is still demand for properties in good locations. Tennyson adds, well-located lots and land that's developable are in short supply. There are a lot of production builders that have bought substantial positions. Sierra would be located just 3 miles from Briar Creek. Other parcels of land around the Leesville-Doc Nichols intersection are also targeted for development, including by Pulte Group, the largest home building company in the Triangle, for a senior adults community on 363 acres. The three parcels owned by East Durham Land Company and Fowler are valued at $12.1 million according to Durham tax records. James Thomas Ross, whose home is on an adjacent property on Leesville Road, says he has seen workers, likely surveyors, on the property. There is a 200-year-old plantation house there, Ross says, where he was born and raised. Ross, 68 years old, says his grandfather had owned the property and he can remember chopping tobacco on the land growing up. Ross says he hopes development won't continue in that area. We've got too much traffic coming through now. Everyone headed to IBM and RTP, he says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Duke's president says university now in recovery. After enduring tough economic times during the Great Recession, and who hasn't, Duke University is in recovery mode, President Richard Brawhead said in a recent address to the university community. During his talk in Reynolds Theater, which was streamed online, Brawhead cited the importance of future capital projects, specifically mentioning a campus in China that Duke is building in the face of concerns expressed by some members of the faculty. He said the university made tough decisions to work out a $100 million deficit, including voluntary retirements and freezing pay raises, a move he says soon will end. Duke fared better than many other universities, Brawhead was quoted as saying by the Duke Chronicle. We shouldn't fool ourselves. We are in better times partly because we help put ourselves in better times, Brawhead said. I would hate for us to loosen up this year and then find that next year we had another problem. As for the China campus, which is projected to cost the university $37 million, he compared it to Duke's decision way back in 1892 to move from Randolph County to Durham, saying it put the university in what today is a cutting-edge community. The Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill has been ranked at number 14 among 500 worldwide properties based on guest reviews received at the Expedia website. Called the Insider Select Awards, Expedia surveys the reviews posted on its website and comes up with an annual list of winners from across the globe. The list of 500 may seem large, but it's not so big when it's considered the Expedia website contains information on 130,000 properties. There is one other Triangle property mentioned in the top 100 of the list. The Washington Duke Inn in Durham was ranked at number 81. Phil Freelon, president of the Freelon Group, and Susan Ward, a philanthropist and retired artist, have been appointed to the NC State University Board of Trustees. In addition, Barbara Mulkey and John Saul were reappointed to the 13-member board that includes 8 trustees elected by the UNC Board of Governors, 4 appointed by the governor, and the president of the student body as the final member. Freelon and Ward are BOG appointees. Freelon, a 1975 graduate of NC State, also serves on boards for UNC-TV and NC State Civil Engineering. His architectural firm, the Freelon Group, is currently working on the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture to be located on the National Mall next to the Washington Monument. As an artist in residence in her hometown of Kinston, Ward works with physically and developmentally disabled students and advocates for animals through the Wake County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and Newfoundland rescue efforts. The North Carolina Department of Transportation is looking for a new deputy secretary for transit after Jim Westmoreland announced that he was leaving that post for a job in the private sector. Westmoreland's last day will be May 27. Until a replacement can be found, COO Jim Trogdon will assume responsibility for overseeing Westmoreland's duties. The Band Together Music Festival raised $460,000 for Alliance Medical Ministry on May 7, setting a handful of records in the process as more than 5,500 music lovers came out to the Lincoln Theater in downtown Raleigh for the concert, headlined by Third Eye Blind. Among the records or firsts set by this year's event, most money ever raised for a charity partner, biggest audience, more than 175 sponsors, a sellout of 2,000 VIP tickets. The money raised will help Alliance Medical Ministry hire a doctor and a nurse, shorten new patient wait time, increase its patient base by 1,500, and increase patient visits each year by 3,000, the group says. It's really cool to be playing in a local community to support a charity like Band Together that supports other local charities, says Chris Reed, lead guitarist for Third Eye Blind, in a statement. You guys rock what you do. Band Together puts on concerts to raise money for area charities. Since its inception in 2001, the organization has helped raise more than $1.4 million for organizations such as Alliance Medical, which works to provide affordable health care to the working uninsured in Wake County. Susan Duncan, executive director of the Loaves and Fishes Ministry, has been honored as a local superhero for kids by the Marbles Kids Museum in downtown Raleigh. Duncan was a volunteer with the ministry for 20 years before being named director. She now leads after-school programs and services for at-risk children in Raleigh. The Downtown Raleigh Home Tour will be May 21, allowing patrons to take a self-guided tour of a variety of downtown housing, ranging from restored historic homes to trendy condos. It's all designed to plug folks into what's come to be known as urban living. Cost of the tour is $10 in advance or $14 on the day of the event. Tours run from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. In conjunction with the tour, the Downtown Raleigh Alliance is offering a $1,000 closing cost incentive to the first 3 event attendees who purchase and close on a home in downtown between May 21 and December 31. The Alliance says the incentive money comes from corporate sponsors. This past Mother's Day weekend, Kids and adults alike flock to the Brick Magic Festival for Lego fans at the Hilton North Raleigh, sponsored by Tomorrow's Incorporated and Brick Journal Magazine. This extravaganza was filled with hundreds of Lego sculptures, along with vendors, workshops, and guests. The guests included David Pagano, who produces stop-motion Lego animation, Jared K. Burks, a custom figure designer, and the guest of honor, Sean Kenny. Kenny's Lego work has been featured in a variety of publications and broadcasts, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, BBC News, and Good Morning America. The main exhibit hall featured thousands of Legos designed into anything imaginable, complete cities with tall skyscrapers, underwater kingdoms, a medieval castle featuring dragons, even a 4-foot-long sculpture of the RMS Titanic were on hand. For a good cause, go karting, or perhaps it should be go-karting. On May 20, all proceeds collected from customers at Rush Hour Karting in Garner will be donated to the American Red Cross for its tornado relief efforts in North Carolina. Folks with the Triangle Chapter of the Red Cross say more than 200 workers and 25 emergency response vehicles have been deployed in the wake of the April 16 storms. On April 18, more than 170 residents spent the night in Red Cross shelters. Rush Hour Karting is in the White Oak Business Park at 5335 Rainer Road and will be open from noon to midnight on May 20. Biz hears that local law firm Allen & Pinnix is moving. The firm plans to relocate its office in August from its current spot at 333 Fayetteville Street over to 510 Glenwood Avenue. The new location, which is in the Glenwood South area, has 11,537 square feet, about 3,700 square feet bigger than the old office. The lease will run for 11 years. Allen and Pinnix's new home is a mixed-use building that was built in 2000 and has a total of 274,000 square feet. Grubb and Ellis, Thomas Linderman Graham's Lee Clyburn, represented Allen and Pinnix in the deal, while William Allen represented landlord Burkham Capital 2 LLC. Noel Allen and Jack Pinnix started the law firm back in 1977. It now has grown to 11 attorneys plus several paralegals and support staff. It took a few months of negotiations to make it happen, but Duke University's Department of Psychiatry has signed a deal to move its research and clinic operations from a building on Rutherford Street behind Irwin Square to the Pavilion East at Lakeview Building on Irwin Road. The university has agreed to lease 28,100 square feet at Pavilion East that had been vacant for 3 years. It will be in addition to the office space the university already leases in the same building for its fetal diagnostic clinic and its division of maternal fetal medicine. Jim Anthony and Marcus Jackson of Colliers International in Raleigh represented the owners of the building in the lease transaction. Scott Selig, Associate Vice President of Capital Assets and Real Estate at Duke University, represented the university in the deal. Bike West, young man. That's just what UNC Chapel Hill junior Joey Parker intends to do beginning on May 14, when he will strike out as a leader of the 30 fellow cyclists embarking on a 3,587-mile trip from Nags Head to San Diego. The bikers, including at least 6 other UNC students, had to raise $4,000 each to participate in the trip, which is projected to take 70 days. The goal of the group, called Bike and Build, is to raise money and build awareness for affordable housing efforts, according to a report in the Daily Tar Heel. They expect to pull into San Diego on July 21. The Gartner Group has put the spotlight on Urban Planet Mobile, a mobile education company in Durham, by naming it one of the 3 cool vendors in education for 2011. Founded by Brian Oliver Smith, UPM delivers English language education over mobile phones, both handsets and smartphones. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Dathan Kazuk, Chris Basden, and Monica Chen. And now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to is the headline, local in-company hands off 30 properties. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And on the far left side of this article, there's a picture from the outside looking up at a hotel with the name Aloft on it. The caption reads, Aloft Hotel in Chapel Hill is among 30 inns shifted. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Alliance Hospitality Management, one of the Triangle's largest hotel management companies, has ceded the management contract it held on 30 hotel properties, or about 60% of its portfolio. Interstate Hotels and Resorts of Arlington, Virginia, has taken over management of the 30 properties, which are spread across 12 states and owned by Inland American Real Estate Trust. Alliance CEO Rolf Tweeden says Alliance sold the management contract to Interstate because it was a lucrative deal for the company. We had just been renewed for 6 years and we sold because it was big money, he says. Tweeden declined to disclose the value of the deal and says the money will be used to recapitalize the company. The deal affects about 1,100 people who were employed by Alliance at the hotels, but Tweeden says Interstate rehired all of those workers. Leslie Ng, Chief Investment Officer of Interstate Hotel and Resorts, did not return calls for comment, but in a press release announcing the management deal, Ng said the hotels would be managed by its Crossroads division, which specializes in properties located in major secondary and suburban markets. We have a strong track record working with institutional investors like Inland American, as well as publicly held companies and individual owners, Ng stated. Alliance still has 20 hotel properties under management and employs about 20 people at its Raleigh headquarters on Glenwood Avenue. Most of the properties transferred to Interstate were once part of a portfolio owned by Raleigh-based Winston Hotels, which Inland acquired for $850 million in 2007. 11 of the hotels are in North Carolina, including the Aloft Hotel in Chapel Hill that Inland built in 2010. Barbara O'Kane, legal counsel and corporate director of human resources for Alliance, says management changes among the hospitality industry are common, and it doesn't mean we won't get others, she says. We have lots of other good stuff coming down the pipeline that we can't comment about yet. Since September, Alliance has renewed management contracts with owners of 5 hotels in Michigan, Texas, and its flagship property, the 169-room Hilton Garden Inn in New York City's Chelsea District. In 2010, Alliance Hospitality ranked at number 25 among the largest third-party hotel management companies in the country, with 46 properties that have 6,421 guest rooms under its management, according to a survey by Hotel and Motel Management magazine. Its revenue in 2010 was $164 million, which was down from $170 million in 2009. Interstate Hotels and Resorts ranked at number 2 in the nation with 225 properties and 46,740 guest rooms under management. Its revenue was up to $1.8 billion from $1.5 billion the year prior, according to the magazine. Another Raleigh-based hotel company, Concord Hospitality Enterprises Company, ranked at number 15 among the largest hotel management companies in the country with 80 hotel properties and 10,401 guest rooms under management. And moving down from that article, we have a article in the center of this page, page 3, with a black border around it. Inside that border, the background is a yellowish beige, and on top of that, at the top half, there's a picture, a large picture at night, looking up from the street at the Raleigh Convention Center. The caption reads, attendance is up, and so are salaries for the Raleigh Convention Center. And then under that is the headline and the article. The headline, salaries up, activity up, Convention Center wages eclipse forecasts by $1 million. And this article is written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Raleigh. The Raleigh Convention Center is paying nearly $2.7 million in staff salaries, 60% more than what had been projected when the facility was in the planning phase. But the center is doing more events than its original forecast, with hundreds of thousands of additional people walking the center's hallways. Consulting firm HVS produced a study in 2003 that projected RCC salaries would total $1.7 million in its second year of operation, the year that corresponds to the 2010 fiscal year. That study was designed to provide a financial roadmap for the then proposed facility. Salaries for the convention center are broken down into two camps. The first are those dedicated specifically to the RCC. The second is administrative salaries, which are shared amongst the center as well as Memorial Auditorium and outdoor venues, says Hazel Cordell, the center's assistant director for finance and business. So why is there such a big difference between the consultants' projected salaries and the actual ones recorded in the 2010 fiscal year? Convention Center Director Roger Grupa points to several factors, including the need for positions such as security guards to watch a door that's open 24 hours a day that weren't foreseen in the HVS report. Just the need for enough guards to provide 24/7 security adds nearly $150,000 a year to the budget. It's 15% of what you're looking at, Grupa says. He also points out that the convention center is hosting more events and more attendees than HVS expected, a good development for local hotels and restaurants. The HVS study had projected that the RCC would host a total of 279,400 attendees at 282 events in its second year. The center actually recorded 443,617 attendees at 366 events. Krupa has the largest budgeted salary on the administrative side at $145,571. Cordell makes $95,000, while facilities manager Michael Barber brings in $91,569. There are about a dozen administrative positions. More than 50 other positions are dedicated solely to the RCC. Those positions include everything from security guards to service technicians to maintenance workers. Hosting 30% more events and 60% more guests than projected requires more employees, says Krupa. We're winning, he says. The real travesty would be if you put this together and it didn't work. Still, the convention center is faced with some challenges, primarily dealing with its fiscal health. While the HVS report estimated that the facility would post an operating deficit of $2.1 million in its second year of operation, the center's actual operating deficit was about $3 million. The additional salary expense was one reason for the larger-than-projected deficit. Another key factor was that the HVS report didn't include a sales and marketing line item, but the center spent $915,000 on that in 2010. Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen says the center's current business model is a little different than that projected by HVS. In regards to the salaries line item, he says the city is constantly evaluating departments to make sure they have appropriate staffing levels, and he's pleased with the convention center's overall performance in terms of being an economic development engine and a community resource. A Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau study shows that hotel room nights increased from 42,521 in 2009 to 62,271 in 2010 for a direct economic impact of $31 million. I think it's done exceptionally well, Allen says of the RCC. I think everyone in the community is proud of it. Business tax cut not dead in North Carolina. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. And it's accompanied by a picture of the governor, Governor Beverly Perdue in her office. The caption reads, Governor Perdue supports cutting corporate tax to 4.9%. Researchers at the General Assembly recently called up North Carolina State University professor Robbie Sawyers and asked a not-so-simple question. How many jobs likely would result under various scenarios if the state's current 6.9% tax on corporate profits was reduced? Sawyers, an accounting professor who has studied the tax and how it relates to the state's business incentive and recruitment programs, didn't have an answer. No one knows, he says. There are no real job creation numbers. Cutting the corporate tax rate is seen in some circles as a way to encourage corporations to create additional jobs. Governor Beverly Perdue advocates cutting the rate to 4.9%. Now, House budget writers reportedly are ready to go her one better with a cut that would take the rate down to 4.75%. Moreover, in their controversial $19.3 billion spending proposal for fiscal 2012, they have reserved $735 million over the next 2 years to pay for a corporate tax cut and perhaps other job creation items. Among measures under consideration are a tax credit for home buyers and a liberalization of depreciation rules for small businesses. The state raised $1.19 billion in corporate taxes in 2010, and through March, the first 9 months of the current fiscal year, $565 million. The reason for cutting the rate as an economic development stimulus measure rests on two main assumptions, namely that lowering the tax would help state recruiters attract new companies into North Carolina, and that in trickle-down fashion, the corporate executives left with more money on their hands would invest it in hiring and business expansion. The Raleigh-based North Carolina Budget and Tax Center finds such arguments unconvincing. Center analyst Edwin McLenahan says that if corporate tax cuts do create jobs, the cost for them would be high, based on lost tax revenue anywhere from $83,000 to $97,000, according to some studies. He also argues that most companies are paying little in corporate taxes as it is. According to the most recent data, a mere 217 businesses paid three-fifths of all state corporate income taxes in North Carolina, McClanahan wrote in a recent report. Thus, approximately three-fifths of any corporate tax cut would flow to 0.12% of North Carolina's 175,000 private employers. Case closed? Not quite. According to North Carolina State University economics professor Mike Walden, who is often consulted, as he was this year, on legislative proposals, a corporate tax cut down to the levels being considered, he believes, would create a significant number of jobs. Though he declines to pin down a number, Walden did allow that job creation over the long haul could equal a capacity crowd in a football stadium. Raleigh Health Agency moving to Cary and expanding. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. To keep up with an exploding healthcare sector, the Raleigh-based Accreditation Commission for Healthcare is moving to Cary and more than doubling its space. It's because of our growth, says Tom Caesar, ACHC president. We're pretty maxed out. Indeed, the nonprofit organization is on a roll financially, having grown revenue from $2.7 million in the 2006 to 2007 fiscal year to $11 million in the 2008 to 2009, according to ACHC's 990 tax filing with the Internal Revenue Service. The organization finished the 2008 to 2009 year with $4.3 million in revenue over expenses or profit. With total assets, including cash, now standing at $11.6 million, ACHC could pay for the $6.5 million building project itself. But Caesar says the organization will finance the expansion so it does not drain its reserve. With interest rates generally low, Caesar says financing is just the better option. The agency accredits healthcare companies nationwide and is based in 12,000 square feet of off Falls of Neuse Road. In the fall of this year, the organization's 25th anniversary, it will break ground at the end of Weston Oaks Court in preparation for a two-story, 30,000-square-foot building. Much of the accrediting work is done in the field by 150 surveyors employed through ACHC, but the agency has grown to 43 employees who work locally and need office space. Also, the new building will have space for training and conferences for the few times surveyors must come in. Currently, ACHC rents hotel or other public space. This will help improve on the business operations, Caesar says. ACHC's move to Cary won't result in an immediate spike in hiring and is more in response to the hiring done throughout the past 20 years. Caesar says he can still remember when there were only two people employed at the office. The investment will be a boost for the Cary economy. Sandy Jordan, Vice President of Economic Development for the Cary Chamber, says his organization typically looks outside the triangle when marketing and does not want to appear as though it is poaching companies from neighboring towns. Still, he says he is very pleased any time an organization locates here. Among the benefits of the move is a lower property tax in Cary compared to Raleigh by about 10%. ACHC is among a handful of organizations nationally that investigate and decide whether to accredit healthcare operations. For Raleigh-based Car Drug, it's a positive that the agency is local. We would consider no other accrediting organization, says Mark Gregory, Car Drug Vice President of Pharmacy and Government Relations. We prefer to have local relationship. In addition to its pharmacy accreditation, the Car brand has sought and received accreditation for Car Health, the group's specialty division. And our next article is written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Hillsborough. The headline, with $16 million in cash on hand, solar firm ready to ramp up. Coming off raising $3.5 million in March, Megawatt Solar, a solar panel maker in Hillsborough, is hoping for high wattage growth this year. Megawatt, founded by three UNC researchers in 2006, will install fourth generation versions of its solar panel structures in the fourth quarter at a Piedmont Membership Electric Corporation plant in Caswell County. The panels will generate up to a total of 250 kilowatts of electricity, with each unit churning out about 1,500 watts. The company already has raised $15.8 million, including the $3.5 million in March, and hopes to close on $10 million in a second round. Megawatt is eyeing another $17 million Series C round for 2012. Since securing the funding in March, the company has boosted employment from 4 people to 16. By the end of the year, Mark Conroy, president and CEO of Megawatt, says the company plans to employ 30 back to the company's staffing level in 2009. The company also has a contract with a California company to expand for the first time beyond North Carolina in early 2012. The company has contracts valued in excess of $20 million. We're just coming out of the startup mode into the commercialization mode, says Conroy. Despite its success on the capital raising front so far, the company is sailing into the headwinds of a tough investment environment for clean tech companies, as well as the loss of some growth momentum in the solar power segment. And Megawatt's fundraising hasn't been without stumbles. Last year, the company applied for $410,000 in a North Carolina Green Business Fund grant that would have come from federal stimulus money. The U.S. Department of Energy rejected the application. Justin Gravatt, director of financing with Megawatt, says his company didn't fit what DOE was looking for, companies poised for commercialization rather than companies still in the research and development stage. To fund growth since its founding, Megawatt has reached internationally for investors. One of its investors, Reidar Langmo, is a co-founder of Renewable Energy Corporation, a Norwegian solar company that had $2.5 billion in revenue in 2010. Langmo chairs Megawatt's board of directors. Julie Robinson, spokeswoman for the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, says major utilities, including Duke Energy and Progress Energy, are in good shape as far as meeting their renewable energy quotas. That means they're less interested in companies such as Megawatt. And this next article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Person Street Acreage May Be Turned Into Urban Farm. The owner of the vacant Person Street Plaza retail center near downtown Raleigh has put on hold his plans to redevelop the partially raised site and will instead donate use of the land for what's envisioned as Raleigh's first urban farm. John Holmes, president of J.T. Hobby & Son, Incorporated, which owns the property, says he hasn't given up on plans to redevelop the Person Street property into a dense mix of residential units and retail space, but he admits it may be several years before the project is economically feasible. What we are trying to do is create interest back into the area, Holmes said. Ideally, we'd like to piggyback the redevelopment of the shopping center off the success of the farm. The organizers of Raleigh City Farm have filed a zoning petition with the city seeking an amendment that would allow for urban agriculture on the 1.3-acre site at the corner of Blount and Person Streets. The vacant property, where four quadruplexes were demolished a few years ago, sits across from the Peace College softball field and is about two blocks north of the Krispy Kreme donut shop. The long-term vision of the group is to turn plots of vacant land across the city into productive farms that would sell produce at local farmers markets or directly to restaurants. Similar urban farm groups have sprung up in Milwaukee, Detroit, Seattle, Phoenix, and other major cities around the country as residents seek new ways to incorporate urban agriculture into developed neighborhoods. While members of the nearby Mordecai neighborhood have largely supported Raleigh City Farms' plan, the project could face challenges because Raleigh planning rules allow community gardens as an accessory use, but not as a principal use, says Raleigh Chief Planning and Economic Development Officer Mitchell Silver. Raleigh's 2030 comprehensive plan that was adopted in 2010 includes an action item encouraging community garden programs, as well as identifying publicly owned sites that may be suitable for community gardens. But the policies make no mention of urban farms such as the one proposed by Raleigh City Farm. Raleigh City Farm would not be a community garden program where members share land to grow produce. Instead, the farm would be managed by a manager who would decide which crops would be planted and when, as well as organize educational workshops for student groups. Should the project get the go-ahead, Raleigh City Farm has agreed to cover the property taxes for the land, which is valued at nearly $856,000. Farmland is typically taxed at a lower rate than other property, but an owner must have at least 5 acres of farmland to qualify for the lower rate. Holmes says the farm operators also would reimburse him for any expenses at the site, but he is not charging them rent. I hope it will be a genesis for something better in the neighborhood, he said. As for organizers of the urban farm, we're running into all kinds of policies and issues that haven't come up before, says Josh Witten, one of the 5 co-founders. Witten says he became interested in the project after he helped start a community garden in a West Morgan neighborhood in 2009. Witten says it will probably be late August before the group can begin tilling the soil for winter crops, if it is successful in getting city approval. Raleigh City Farm is classified as a not-for-profit organization, but it is seeking nonprofit status. Its 5 founders are Witten, Laura Fieselman, Laurel Vernado, Aaron Bergstrom, and Jonathan Morgan. Aaron Sterling Lewis, a resident of the nearby Mordecai residential neighborhood and a partner with the In Situ Studio architecture firm in Raleigh, is working pro bono with Raleigh City Farm on its site design. It's sort of like Central Park, Lewis says in reference to New York City's Fame Park. This is a new and innovative way to weave urban agriculture throughout the community. And with our remaining time, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. WakeMed will make bid to buy Rex. WakeMed Health and Hospitals intends to make a $750 million bid to buy crosstown competitor Rex Hospital, which is owned by UNC Healthcare System. WakeMed of late has complained that the playing field is not level in the Triangle market because UNC Healthcare is subsidized by state funding and Rex Hospital benefits from that fact. Durham boasts highest wages in South. Salaries are higher in Durham than anywhere else in the South. That's the finding of a study by the Business Journals, a division of Charlotte-based American City Business Journals, the parent company of Triangle Business Journal. The Business Journal study found that the typical worker in the Durham metropolitan area, Durham, Orange, Chatham, and Person counties, earned $50,480 in 2009, according to data compiled by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Raleigh-Cary Metropolitan Statistical Area, Wake, Johnston, and Chatham counties, ranked number 10 in the South with an average salary of $43,370. Rocky Top opens new Raleigh restaurant. The High Five Sports Bar and Restaurant at 510 Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh's Glenwood South has reopened under a new name and as a slightly different concept called Draft Carolina Burgers and Beers, though it remains under the same Rocky Top Hospitality ownership. Draft Carolina Burgers and Beers will serve more than 40 different beers, all originating from North Carolina breweries, including Rocky Top's own Mash House beers. Forbes, in Raleigh, blasts Fed. Steve Forbes, the editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine and 2-time presidential hopeful, said in Raleigh that the U.S. government is deliberately trashing its money. and keeping the recovery in first gear because of its policies, particularly those of the Federal Reserve. Forbes traveled to six cities, including Raleigh, in 2.5 days with Northwestern Mutual Chairman and CEO John Schlifske to promote the company's financial products and discuss the nation's monetary policies. Forbes saved some of his harshest criticisms for the Federal Reserve's $600 billion bond buying program called QE2. Not to be flippant about it, but if printing money was the way to recover an economy, why not legalize counterfeiting, he said. Quintiles lining up $2.2 billion in credit. Quintiles Transnational is moving forward with plans to enter into $2.2 billion in credit facilities. IMAX Theater to open in Durham. The owner of the South Point Cinemas at the streets at South Point Mall in Durham will open an IMAX Theater Friday, May 20, with the 3D premiere of Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Stone Theaters of Charlotte, the owner of South Point Cinemas, is building a new 6,240-square-foot theater room with a screen that will be 62.5 feet wide. The auditorium will have 358 seats with 24-inch faux leather rockers positioned on 21-inch risers for unobstructed viewing. It will also feature the latest in IMAX projection technology and digital audio equipment. The South Point IMAX Theater will be the third in the Triangle region. The Marbles Kids Museum in downtown Raleigh and the Regal Crossroads Stadium 20 in Cary also have IMAX theaters. And we have just a few seconds left to read the beginning of this article concerning Capital Bank. The headline, Owner Cleanses Capital's Books of Loans, Loan Provisions. It's written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. A newly restructured Capital Bank has entered 2011 knocking on the door of profitability. With more cash on its books, seven fewer employees, and a reduction of $75 million in real estate loans. Showing a net loss of $33 million as of 2010 ended, the new capital had those losses cut those losses by 98%. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.